as energy is radiated from the sun, absorbed into the earth grinds it up, animals eat each other, and they're breaking that energy down, and then eventually all of that energy will be radiated out into space. And the question is, do we want to go with that, or do we want to fight against it?
This is the Ecology of Ideas podcast, the podcast about how the ecological crisis is foremost a crisis in our ways of thinking. I'm Otto De Marta. When we hear the word ecology, we typically think about our planet. However, there is a much bigger cosmic ecology going on, which our planet is only a small part of. To give us some guidance on how to take ecological thinking to the cosmos, I invited Thomas Nail, professor in philosophy at the University of Denver, Colorado. We'll talk about how this cosmic ecology is an ecology of entropy, that is, of energy and its increasing dissipation and ultimate death of the universe, and how we humans need to stop fighting against this process and become agents of entropy. And now, let's welcome Thomas to the podcast. Hi, Thomas. Welcome to the Ecology of Ideas podcast. It's great to have you all the way from Denver calling in. How are you doing?
Great. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself so our audience gets to know you?
Yeah, I'm a professor at the of philosophy at the University of Denver. I work on all kinds of stuff, philosophy of movement and, you know, environment. I don't know. I can't list it all. I won't list it all.
It's a very long list. Yeah.
It's too long of a list. I just work on a bunch of things. But today we're gonna talk about, you know, ecology. And that's great.
Yeah. And we'll have a look at what philosophy can bring, I guess, to a better understanding what it means to be part of, an intimate part of the cosmos, even, right? So we'll go all the way up to a cosmic level. But before I get there, what do you think can philosophy bring to the discussion?
Wow. Philosophy is a very broad thing, and lots of different things can be brought. I will maybe just speak for myself, because I think many philosophers are very different. I will speak for myself when I say philosophy can help us change our minds about the way we're thinking about things. Yeah. I think it's exactly the topic of this podcast. There are many solutions to climate change, environmental damage, ecological injustice, but they all have assumptions behind them of what's important and how to go about doing those things, whether that's conservation or carbon sequestration. They all have assumptions, and more than they maybe possibly know. And philosophy, at least in my view, helps us interrogate what the deepest fundamental assumptions that we're making when we go about trying to do good or making mistakes and thinking about how to proceed. We're making all kinds of assumptions, and philosophy can help us reframe things. Philosophy can't solve concretely very many problems, but it can change the way we think about how we solve them. And that is just as important, and in some cases even more important than sort of concretely trying to solve a particular case, possibly in the wrong way.
Yeah, right. What got you into philosophy? I'm curious.
I got into philosophy through punk rock music, actually.
Why am I not surprised? tell us that story.
I think I was maybe like 16 or something, and I remember listening to this band, this Canadian punk rock band, Propagandhi, and their lyrics were just very political. I mean, it was my entryway into a whole world of like very politically engaged punk music. And I did not understand what the hell they were talking about. And, you know, all these references in their lyric books back in the day when we used to read little books that came with CDs or whatever.
I remember.
Little essays and quotes by Noam Chomsky. I'm like, who the heck is Noam Chomsky?
Yeah.
And I remember getting into political theory specifically through trying to understand what was going on in a lot of those punk lyrics, and understanding that there are a lot of problems in the world, and I was very angry about all of it, and trying to understand why it was happening. is still, it never went away. That's still my question is like, why is the world still so fucked up? I still want to know the answer to that. I want to understand where all that came from. So that's how I got into philosophy and became a political activist for many years, and always thought of my philosophy as kind of always going hand in hand with my political activism, animal rights, environmental justice, food not bombs, been an anarchist for a really long time. Like, right. I've just always kind of done those things together. So,
yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because in a way you have a very particular take on philosophy, and especially also the way we address ecological issues. There is a touch of anarchy, and that we shouldn't take stability for granted. More of a delusion of our sense of superiority, that they think everything's stable around us. The world is just a stage for us to act on.
My perspective about, some of the bigger changes that we need to make in our thinking are kind of fundamental. I mean, on the face of them, they might sound kind of abstract, but in some ways they couldn't be more concrete. And one of those, as you're saying, is the assumption about stability. We really take that for granted, but it's important to realize this is not a universal human assumption, that different societies historically have had really different expectations and assumptions about how predictable, how stable the world should be, and what is truly kind of ontologically fundamental for the world's oldest recorded world mythologies. It's chaos. Everything comes from chaos. Everything is process oriented.
Yeah.
Everything's born, everything dies. And that is the fundamental orientation. And all that begins to majorly change around the 6th century BCE.
Okay.
And now we kind of live in the wake of that, of the removal of chaos from our ontologies, and have, in my opinion, kind of undo and kind of weirdly differently metaphysical assumptions than probably most human beings on the planet have had.
Yeah.
And that is that we expect things to be ordered. And then so climate change is understood to be we need to get back to stability. But there just was no back to stability. And I'm thinking about the Egyptians, Mesopotamians, ancient Chinese, early archaic Greek poetry, Homer, the Rig Veda. The cosmos begins with this kind of primordial process. Everything is moving. Everything is shape changing. It's dark. It's fluid. It's indeterminate. It's boundless. And then out of that, form begins to emerge out of that indeterminacy and what we might call a kind of meta stability, which is different than stability. Stability is fixed, and there's nothing with respect to contemporary science. Nothing we know actually is static. Everything that we've been able to observe is moving to some degree. If we're even talking about the thermodynamic level, or we're talking about the quantum level, everything's moving around. And that does lend a certain validity to the idea that things began that way. They've always been that way, but they've distributed into relatively metastable patterns, like a vortex swirling around in water is metastable. It's just there as long as there's water running through it. And the moment you cut the water off, the vortex is gone. And that shows you that forms are emergent properties of much larger thermodynamic systems. But anyway, to me, in my mind, all of this suggests strongly that these oldest kind of mythological traditions had an intuition, which was deeply correct, that the world is fundamentally sort of unstable and indeterminate, but that gains relatively stable forms over time and history. And we shouldn't expect that they will remain stable.
You've been talking about metastability. If you could help us understand what you mean by that and why it's so important for your thinking.
Yeah, by metastable, I mean something that is not fixed. Like, it's not stable in the sense that it's absolutely fixed and it doesn't change, but it's not totally unstable. Like, it's just kind of flailing around without any order or pattern. Metastable structure is one that changes as the things around it change. And a great example that I always think about is a vortex or an eddy in water. So, if you look at a stream and the water is moving in the stream, But if you look off to the side, maybe there's some rocks that have slowed the water down, and around the edges, you see that the water has kind of turned in a circle around itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, not in a circle, but in a spiral. But the thing is, the water is coming into the eddy, cycling through and cycling out again. So it's never the same water. It's totally different. The water is different every time, but what's metastable is the form, the shape of the vortex, which is constantly changing a little bit, but enough that you can point to it and say, "Ah, oh, there's an eddy." But you know, there is no stuff there that's the same stuff that, you know, was different 1 second ago than what it is now. But that's one concrete example. But in a very broad way, all of the forms of the universe work that way. Mm. Energy's coming in, like you and me, we eat food. The flow of energy comes in, it gets broken down, digested, released, and we're still here. You know, so we're like that eddy in a way that that living organisms are metastable states that take in energy, cycle it through, and then release it. And here I'm thinking about just thermodynamics. That's the one thing in this universe that is, you know, happening everywhere, is entropy. Mm. Everything is moving from a higher state of energy to a lower state, but as it's spreading out, it's creating relatively stable patterns. Just like a vortex in water, you have galaxies forming, around supermassive black holes. It's just like water going down a drain. This process is happening at every scale. And those are kind of metastable ways that as energy is on its way out, spreading, it creates these kind of little pockets where it can really release much faster. And galaxies are, you know, they're just grinding up and releasing tons of energy all the time, much faster than non-galaxy places in the universe. And that's, you know, we can go with that and we can say, yeah, let's go with this process of dissipation and help the universe really spread out and more rapidly dissipate its energy. And by doing that, it doesn't mean like self-destruction, quite the opposite. It means increasing the metastable structures. And that's what the planet is. It's a metastable structure. As you know, energy is radiated from the sun, absorbed into the earth. The earth grinds it up, you know, reuses it over and over and over again. And animals down and up the trophic pyramid, you know, eat each other, and they're breaking that energy down. And then eventually all of that energy will be radiated out into space. And the question is, do we want to go with that? Mm-hmm. Or do we want to fight against it? Do we want to try to slow the process of entropy down and sort of, you know, drag our feet?
Can you help us understand this point about kind of, pun intended, that the point of the universe, if there is one, is to dissipate energy, because it goes against what we traditionally would think about what our role in the universe is to preserve and save and accumulate. Because this is a very important point that I would like to pick up on, this dissipation.
I mean, one way to think about it, sometimes physicists will use this term negentropy, which they use to characterize life, that living organisms, they say, are sort of resisting entropy in their existence. And other things like rocks, they just kind of go with entropy and they, you know, dissipate that energy. But living organisms will reproduce themselves and fight so that they won't be dissipated. Mm-hmm. And this is just from a thermodynamic perspective. This is wrong. That's not what happens. Living organisms just objectively dissipate way more energy than rocks do. Life is not resisting entropy. Or living organisms are going with the flow of entropy even more than rocks are, because they are consuming more energy and they are releasing more energy per square area of their bodies than rocks are. So if you looked at the total energy consumption and dissipation, you'd see that it's vastly higher in organisms. And what that shows you is that life is about increasing dissipation over non-life. That's one of its features. It has nothing to do with resisting entropy. It has to do with creating a metastable state, just like a little eddy or a vortex in water. living organisms take in energy, cycle it through themselves, and release it, 9/10 of it to be exact, at every scale of the trophic pyramid, every time something eats something else, it basically wastes 9/10 of that energy. And it only stores or uses to reproduce its organism 1/10 of that. So, but what that tells you when you look at that pyramid biologically is that the planet, at least, you know, the living organisms on the planet, they evolved to increase their rate of dissipation. And I can't show you the diagram right now, but I do have a nice diagram in my book showing you exact. You can see that over the course of the evolution of life, simple early organisms dissipate very little relative energy, where they break relatively little energy down per like how big they are.
Mm-hmm.
But as evolution occurs, the animals get, you know, animals and other living organisms get larger and larger and larger. But importantly, they also become increasingly, they consume more energy and release more energy per their mass. So they're increasing the rate of dissipation. They are not resisting entropy. They are not slowing down the cosmic decay and dissipation. They are amplifying it. And that is one of the things, especially in mammals, neurons. I mean, well, neurons are more, but they, neurons in mammals are extremely energy intensive. It is a huge, like when we sit around right now and we're talking, we don't think about it in this way, but you know, from a thermodynamic perspective, we're just sitting here radiating energy off out of our heads. In any case, I think that's the bigger picture,
right.
Is that everything is kind of going with the flow, and to relative degrees, you know, it's not that it's equal everywhere. Again, galaxies are doing it fast. Planets, especially like ours, life and living organisms, the universe is trying to dissipate energy, but it's never clear how it's going to do that. And it invents and experiments with all kinds of forms, our planet included, that are ways and methods of like, was this going to increase entropy or not? Or is it going to slow it down or not? And I think it's not all humans. It's very much of specific historical geographical moment of kind of Eurasian philosophy and metaphysics that has really shifted away from this idea. And thermodynamics in the 19th century brings back this problem of like, hey, you know, as far as we know in physics thing, every entropy is happening all over the place. And there are these, and like, this is this dark moment of like, well, what about, you know, who's going to save us? Like, what's all this progress for? What's the point of civilization and all of the cosmos? It led many people to nihilism, you know, to think like, oh, this is like the darkest, most terrible reality. But the thing is, that was never a new idea.
Yeah.
Thousands and thousands of people for a vast majority of prehistory thought about already things in that sense of chaos giving birth to the world and the world eventually dying and returning to that chaos.
There's two thoughts that come to my mind. Maybe let me start with the second one, because I think that would help us close that chapter off and move to a different section or a different chapter of the conversation. And that is the language you draw on is very cosmological. So you don't make a big fuss about distinguishing rocks from humans or the sun from, I don't know, galaxies. And in a sense, that broadens the horizon tremendously, because if you come back to the notion of ecological thinking, one of the ways I think about what it is to think ecologically is to understand that you're an intimate part of the world. You don't just live in a world, you're an intimate part of it. And by now, I guess many of us understand how we are intimately connected to the planet we live in, we live on. And here you go, we don't live on a planet, we are the planet. Maybe the sun and the moon, that we are intimately connected to them, one way or another. But you are expanding it to a whole cosmological level, that we are intimately connected to galaxies and the past and the future. And can you help us understand this idea of how ecology is more than planetary nature, for instance?
Yeah, that's a great, I mean, that is definitely what the, you know, my book Theory of the Earth is all about. I think thermodynamics is one way to think about our part of that world. Because everything is doing that, that's something we're doing too.
Yeah.
That makes us very much doing what the rest of the cosmos is doing. Now, we're doing it in our own way. I'm not saying there's nothing different than a rock, than life. Of course, there's something different, but it doesn't mean that life is somehow magical or unique in a radical, right, like not part of nature or this world, yeah, sort of way. It doesn't mean there's anything fundamentally special. There's just differences. Everything is different. Everything is special in its own way. Nothing is uniquely unique. Mm. And, you know, thermodynamics, I think, is part of that story that connects us with the rest of the cosmos. As Carl Sagan, you know, says, we're all star stuff.
Yeah, literally. That's, you know, the beauty of it. We are literally star stuff.
We're literally star stuff. Yeah. I mean, that, you know, it's been quoted so many times that it's banal, but it's important to remember that there's so many little special features about our bodies that are, you know, made, yeah, of, yeah, you know, hydrogen. And where did that hydrogen come from? I mean, you know, all this stuff, these are, you know, subatomic particles and, you know, atoms that have been bouncing around the cosmos for billions, yeah, of years. Yeah. And now they're us. And now we deal with, you know, regular bombardment of cosmic radiation through the Earth's atmosphere that alters, you know, and then as the solar system moves through the Milky Way galaxy, you know, it has tendrils and arms, and sometimes we pass through, you know, meteor showers, you know, and debris that would have, you know, technically destroyed us a long time ago,
yeah,
if it weren't for massive planets like Jupiter, you know, that really protect us because of their gravitational force and the asteroid belt. There's a whole solar ecology, you know, yeah, as
yeah,
well,
yeah,
but that we don't think about, but it's, and that one, maybe we don't think about it because it's so deeply out of our control. And we think that the Earth is somehow more under our control, which I guess might be relatively true, but it's certainly not absolutely true.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, there is a cosmic ecology that we're part of, and that it makes a lot of sense to think about at a much larger perspective when we think about ecological,
yeah,
problems.
Yeah, yeah, because it also boils down to the concrete issues and ecological crisis we have here on our planet, mm-hmm, we're trying to deal with, right? So I guess on the one hand, we have the philosophical challenges of understanding what our role is in quote-unquote reality. And the other one is to understand, I guess, that there is a bigger drama at play that doesn't really care about us humans. And in that sense, it's not only that we are special, but that we also develop this sense of superiority over, let's say, I don't know, a rock, that we feel superior over a rock, which in some sense, I guess, is understandable. But from your perspective, a rock is just as much part of this drama as we humans are. And in fact, it's our sense of superiority that got us into trouble to begin with.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that's a relatively uniquely kind of Indo-European historical idea that somehow that stasis comes first in
yeah,
various forms, whether
yeah,
that's pure form, whether it's God, unmoved movers, whatever, you know, divine forms. These are all inventions.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody at some point invented these around the 6th century and said, these are that fundamentally the world is order and form.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
things that and then there's things that deviate from those perfect forms or those orders that are divined. And that makes those things relatively ontologically inferior. And in the West, it's called the great chain of being, where God is on top, or the forms are on top, and pure knowledge is on top. And then humans, you know, are above animals, and animals above plants, and plants above rocks. And of course, men above women. And,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
it's, this is the same, this hierarchy. You don't even need to know what it is to see that it's at work everywhere in, you know, Indo-European influenced cultures.
Mm-hmm.
This is their way of thinking about the world. But for, yeah, many indigenous people, it's not. It's completely ludicrous.
Mm.
And plants and animals have a kind of intelligence, and they take that seriously. Indigenous people, they don't think about rocks as being like ontologically inferior.
Yeah.
And in,
yeah,
many ways, animals and trees, for instance, I mean, they're older. They were here before humans were. It's a totally different way of thinking. Europeans tend to think about humans as being like special and really, really smart,
yeah,
on a planet filled with stupid animals and, yeah, plants that don't know anything or understand anything. And the different orientation is that for many indigenous people, humans are, and this is just like geologically and evolutionary factual, they are late on the scene. They're very young.
Mm-hmm.
And for that reason, they have a lot to learn. And where are they going to learn it? But from the older beings on the planet, And it doesn't mean necessarily like, oh, you know, let's do an interview with a tree and figure out what we can learn. It's not that kind of learning. It's a different kind of learning, but there is something to learn from trees. And yeah. I know that's one of your questions that you want to talk about too, is what we have to learn from trees, because there is a lot to learn. They have been here for 300 million years and they know a lot about what it means to live on this planet. And we are very young. We just showed up here not so long ago. It's not a question of like, let's just leave nature alone. You know, there is this idea.
Because we are nature, right?
Exactly. We are nature. I mean, we're going to be messing with it all the time.
Yeah.
The question isn't like, oh, should we mess with it or leave it alone? No, that's not. And like the way that, you know, many Europeans and anthropologists thought about indigenous people, like, oh, indigenous people, they just leave the land and let it do what it's going to. No, they don't.
No,
they absolutely don't. All the studies show they intervene in like every aspect of the ecological system, but they do so in a way that is metastable. They don't expect that they can just chop down an entire forest. And just keep doing that, or, you know, overfish certain regions, you know, and I mean, they can make mistakes too. They're not perfect people either. They're like, there's a danger of kind of romanticizing like, oh, if we're in harmony, we'll do everything right or not, you know, like we're just, you know, human. There's all these contingencies again that go up to the cosmic and the solar and the terrestrial, and all of these various cycles alter and change and people have to adapt. We try things out, we make mistakes. But the point is if you have to hold on to some sense that you're trying to create a metastability and you're being careful about it. That's the difference. The difference is, I think that there's a reciprocity, a respect, an acknowledgement of instability and unpredictability that goes quite deep for many indigenous peoples, that they don't expect that things will always be identical and stable. Yeah. And so they're not perfect and their experiments can fail too. And they might overfish and they might overhunt, but they're not trying to, and they make attempts not to. Whereas, you know, we could go on a long history of all the ridiculous ideas of, you know, people building giant dams and just exterminating whole wolf populations and thinking everything will be fine. These are all examples of a deep assumptions. You might think, oh, well, you know, they're trying to solve problems, but they're trying to solve problems. They're going to have the wrong metaphysical or philosophical starting point. They're assuming that everything is static. They're assuming that everything will be stable and you could just pull a piece of the Jenga, you know, from the bottom and everything will be fine. But you can't just eliminate wolves. You can't just eliminate entire species.
Yeah.
You can't just deforest 1,000-year-old rainforest and expect that everything will be just like it was.
So that was one point I got out of what you were talking about. That's just, you know, that's ecologically speaking, there is a ecological cosmos at play here, and we're different maybe, but we have no superior role in that play, if you will. But the other one, and I think that's the most provocative part of your thesis, is if I understand you again correctly, you're suggesting that waste is actually natural. Nature is wasteful. The cosmos is wasteful. And us trying to control, mitigate, minimize that is part of the problem, if not the problem.
Yeah. This is the tricky thing, and the thing that I was most surprised at when I wrote the book Theory of the Earth and ended up coming to this conclusion. Just by kind of looking at the numbers, just to understand what was happening on the planet from a thermodynamic perspective, is that the idea of conservation that we have of, well, let's reduce, you know, let's hoard our energy, let's consume our, like, let's accumulate it, let's reduce the amount, like the orientation is that, oh, we're using too much energy. And I don't think that humans, or at least specific groups of humans, are using too much. That's not the point. Isn't the quantity, because the quantity that humans are using is absolutely minuscule compared to what the rest of the planet is doing. And I, you know, there's this Vaclav Smil is the guy, the energy theorist, who's like collected tons of data on this over like 30 books in his entire career, looking at the energy use, like how much energy does a hurricane release? how much energy does lightning release? Yeah. And he like calculates all this stuff and puts it all together. And when you look at those things, I mean, most of those are relatively small on the planet compared to what is the largest biomass on the planet are trees.
Mm.
Trees are the largest. That 80% of the biomass on the planet is trees. And relative to their size, because they're relatively kind of late in the material evolution of the planet, relative to their size, they're extremely efficient at absorbing energy and breaking it down and releasing it back, wasting it, if you will. Only 1%. So trees take in all kinds of energy, both from the sun and from the soil and the water and nutrients, and they only save for themselves 1% of that energy. In order to maintain and rebuild the cellular structure of their bodies and to grow. 1%. So that's definitely less than the, 10% even of a lot of other organisms. Trees have been around for a while, and this is a technique that they've developed. And we could say that they're wasting that energy into the air through transpiration. That's another thing I really wish everybody could see with like special glasses. You put them on and you can see all of the water vapor just pouring out of every tree. I mean, thousands of gallons a day are just pouring out of trees, but in such a fine mist that we can't see it,
yeah.
But we're breathing it. They're breathing our breath. We're breathing their breath. And I just wish that we could see that. I think we would think about the world quite differently if we could. But we would also see the thermodynamics at work when we could, if we could see that. We could watch it happening before our eyes. And we would see how much trees dissipate. In any case, that is the main, when you add up how much that is, and the numbers are in the book, and I don't have them all on top of my head. You have to look at the diagrams in the book and see, but it is more, it's more than any of these other things, any other like hurricanes, lightning, it's more than any of that per square area on the planet. So that's an important thing that I was like, oh, okay. So trees are really some of the main thermodynamic agents, on the planet
right.
for just breaking energy down. But that process of breaking energy down is also what they're wasting it, quote, you can't see my air quotes, but they're wasting it. But really what they're doing is they're making the weather, they are really though that water vapor becomes clouds, which becomes rain, which goes back and rains back down into that same forest. And, creates, biodiverse areas where you have rainwater and wind and all the, and a mix of nutrients and so on. So they're really sustaining these whole kind of ecological weather systems. A lot of ecologies, not all of them, but sort of take place under the protection and the thermodynamic action of trees, or even just large shrubs and plants will still release a certain degree of that. Now, I'm almost forgetting exactly what your question was. Oh yeah, about like what this tells us about our place in all of this. What this tells us is that trees have been around for 300 million years and they've figured this out, that it's really important to waste energy, to accumulate and hoard very little of it and share it. We would call it waste. And I think that word has all of these metaphysical kind of connotations that waste is bad.
Yeah.
And what's really good is accumulation. And conservation, but from a thermodynamic perspective, the goal is not to conserve energy on the planetary scale. The goal on the planetary scale is to help the planet dissipate as much energy as possible, and that doesn't mean releasing a bunch of carbon into the atmosphere. Because so you could say, oh well, sure, let's help dissipate energy. Let's dig up a bunch of fossil fuels and burn them into the sky and
drive
look at all the energy
cars,
released.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Everybody drive SUVs. We need to like dissipate more energy on the planet.
Yeah.
This is or the reverse, which is we need to stop doing all kinds of energy, stop using so much energy, so we reduce that our energy. This is a very anthropocentric orientation where we are the ones calculating our energy, our footprints, our whatever. And when we think about it from our perspective, we are missing the larger ecological and cosmic thermodynamic perspective, which is not about conservation or accumulation. It is about sharing. It's about reciprocity. I give to you just in the form of a gift, which is waste, which is energy. All of us are physically just radiating that out, sharing it with the rest of the world. And that's why I wish we could see it, to see that our waste is someone else's food. And the moment where you start releasing all those fossil fuels goes in the atmosphere, sinks into the ocean, acidifies the ocean, kills the fish, right? And it has all of these repercussions. And some of the biggest repercussions, obviously the ocean is huge, a huge repercussion, but the other is deforestation. By destroying half the trees on the planet, and if they're 80% of what is releasing energy on the planet, we have reduced, we have not increased the total energy. This is the punchline, okay? Planetary energy use has been roughly reduced by half since the beginning of the Holocene. Okay, even though human energy use, we could, now there's a separate diagram in the book where you can watch, you know, that everybody knows this, you can imagine it, it's the hockey stick.
Yeah.
Energy in the beginning, it's very, very slow, very, very low for, like, you know, through the Neolithic and even early empires and civilizations. And then it spikes up like absolutely crazy during industrialization and even more around the last 30 years. Human energy use has just gone bonkers in a short period of time. But when you put that into the scale, what they are doing, it's not their energy consumption or dissipation per se. It's the fact that they've done that based on their destruction of the biomass of the planet. Now, obviously, the animals and the biodiversity are related, but trees are really integral to that. So by destroying half the trees, we've reduced half the energy dissipation. So humans have not increased the dissipation of energy on the planet. They've reduced it. And by reducing it, imagine this. You have, again, let's go back to the eddy of water draining through your bathtub. You have water going down into the drain. And as long as that water's going, the vortex can be stable, metastable. But the moment you start to slow the water that's going in, like you put your hand down to block the water going into the drain, the vortex disappears. Or if you just reduce that water by like slowing it down with some barrier, the vortex will begin to wobble. It'll become wide and unstable and become very weak and shallow. And if you cut it off entirely, the vortex disappears. That's essentially what we're doing with the planet. We are blocking that flow of energy by destroying half the amount of trees. I mean, again, lots of other things we're destroying, but deforestation of rich old ecosystems, those are some of the biggest entropy producing organisms or systems on the planet. So by reducing that, we've essentially destabilized the metastable state. And the way to restabilize it, and this is the kind of the other part of the punchline, to restabilize it, we have to increase the flow of energy to let the water run, you know, let the energy rip through the planet and dissipate as it's going to. And that involves increasing the entropy of the entire planet, not just our energy use, but all of the planet's energy use. So even though the metaphysics of conservation, people use that word like, oh, we're conserving and we need to conserve energy. It's maybe some of the things people might do could be good in the name of conservation, but there's a mismatch between their philosophical assumption about what they're doing and what they're actually doing. Composting, for instance, you might say, oh, like I personally, I'm a composter. I love composting. It's basically my religion. And when I do it, you know, like you could do composting and you would be having a good effect on the planet, but not for the reasons you think.
Yeah.
You think, oh, I'm saving energy. So now I'm not going to, instead of my organic waste going to a landfill in a plastic bag where it will sit and rot and it won't decompose for a very long time because it's anaerobic. There's no oxygen under those giant landfills. And so my banana peel will be there for a really, really long time before it breaks down because no bacteria can get to it to fully digest it. But if I do it myself, then I'm saving a weight of a dump truck that has to go, and I'm saving all the methane that will be released. So you could think, oh, I'm reducing my footprint. But here's another way to think about that. You are playing the cosmic game of dissipation when you compost, because it's not a, you're not, okay, fine, you are reducing the landfill methane, et cetera. But really what you're doing is you're growing and increasing the number of bacteria and fungus on the planet. You are creating your own little biodiverse ecosystem. If it's a good compost pile, you're creating an entire little cosmos, which is massively proliferating a huge number of organisms, which are eating that waste and releasing that waste into the ground, into the atmosphere. and you are increasing cosmic entropy. Now, you don't have to think about it this way, but I like to think about it this way. By composting, you are not decreasing entropy. You are increasing entropy because you are giving birth to billions and billions of bacteria and fungi and then growing things out of it. And those things you're growing from the garden, if you're using the compost, those, it too, are increasing entropy, not decreasing it.
Right, right. It's in a sense, you know, let's liberate the notion of waste from its negative connotations then.
There you go.
Let's do that. you know, because there is obviously a difference between waste in the sense of plastic bottles, right? That will take forever to decompose. That's, I guess, would be a way of thinking about waste in a sense of accumulation, because you're accumulating plastic all over the place. Or CO2 in the atmosphere is also kind of an accumulation of that. You just dump it somewhere out of sight and you think it will never come back. This magical thinking of this, a place called away you can just throw your trash at.
Okay.
But then the kind of waste you're talking about is, let's, I don't know how to call it, entropically active kind of waste. And I would really like to unpack that so we don't end up in a misunderstanding that we should just waste more in the sense of, yeah, just drink more plastic bottles. You're fine. You're fine.
Right.
You're doing the universe's will. Let's unpack that a little bit. In the last stage of the podcast is this notion of entropy, because maybe we want to start there of what you mean by it, because that may be already misunderstood. And how, let's just stick to humanity, because we all can somewhat relate to that, how humanity is or isn't a entropic agent, as you called it, an entropic actor.
Yeah. So I guess my definition of entropy would be, and I mean, it's not that there is a clear, I mean, just to be in the history of science and the discussion, I mean, there's debates over how to define entropy.
Yeah.
It's not like there is a universal, description which has been there for all time.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of precursors too, to the study and history of entropy. Despite whatever you'd learn in a physics class, things aren't usually so clear cut about how to understand it. So the definition that I'm using and that I gave before is that entropy is just the spreading out of energy in the cosmos from a high concentration to a lower concentration. So you can think about the Big Bang spreading out in all directions. As it spreads out, it doesn't spread out evenly. It's got all kinds of ripples and distortions and turbulence, and that's why the cosmos looks the way it does, with all kinds of galaxies and planets and so on. It's because you've got all this uneven spread and lumps and accumulation, you know, that sweet spot right between, you know, when cream goes into coffee, those beautiful little swirls, and then eventually it'll all be mixed in and it'll just be a lighter brown color, and, you know, the universe, that'll be it. So that's all I mean by entropy. And humans are, whether they like it or not, they're part of that. That is what they're doing, despite it, their fantasies that, you know, they won't be part of that, or they'll somehow escape to a transcendent realm outside of nature. In any case, what was your second question?
I don't remember myself. Then I already came up with three others.
You asked me what was entropy, and then waste, distinguishing between waste. There's good waste and bad waste. And so waste in the sense that's sharing.
Yeah.
That is generous. That gives back. Waste that gives back. And the example here, composting, that's a form of waste that gives back. And that creates life, and that creates and increases entropy. And plastic bottles, I mean, that's what's so weird, is people think about plastic bottles and landfill, they're like, oh, that's like a waste pile. But the thing is, what you're calling a waste pile is actually like an ultimate form of accumulation and hoarding.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't think about us hoarding our garbage.
Yeah.
But from a thermodynamic perspective and from an ecological perspective, if you imagine like aliens looking at the planet and being like, what's up with these people? Like, they're taking all of these goods and then they put them in they bury them in the ground. They might get the impression that these goods were very sacred and important to us.
Oh,
so
important that
we didn't want them to die. I mean, just like, you know, the Egyptian pharaohs, or just like, you know, the idea of preserving the body or preserving something that's not going to decay, that will live on past whatever, they might think, well, this is a funerary activity. If you look at Neolithic cultures, I mean, or early human cultures, they buried things that that were important to them.
Yeah.
And now we bury all of our plastic bottles and plastic diapers and uranium and all kinds of stuff in the ground. That is because I think that this is a deep metaphysical assumption that we will not let even our waste or even our garbage decay. It will live on thousands of years beyond us. Like, I would like my waste to live on beyond, you know, we don't think about it in that way, but I think that is the assumption, is that we won't even let our trash die. It's going to live. It has to be kind of this like vampire or something that lives on, but it lives on at the expense. Think of all of that stuff in landfills that could be giving birth to bacteria and fungi and growing forests. And instead it's locked away from the rest of the planet so that nobody can eat it. So we're not sharing our waste.
Yeah.
You know, when you make a plastic bottle, you make it so that it can't be shared very easily. You know, plastic bottles and stuff, there's fungus that can eat it. But like, we're not sharing with those fungus, you know, we're not sharing with the rest of the world. And that sounds weird to that sharing our waste should be such an ethical activity. But I think that if we change our thinking about it, waste should be an ethical gift, you know, that we give back to the rest of the world and share it with all those organisms that want to live off of it. And if we make a bunch of plastic, guess where it's going to end up? Back inside of us. You know, we digest like a credit card worth of microplastics every week. Yeah, we're eating it, you know, like that stuff, you know, it doesn't always stay in the landfill. It does get out there in the world, but in such a way that it doesn't productively share, not just with other people, but even with ourselves. So, you know, we're going to end up eating that plastic obviously disproportionately populations are affected by, you know, environmental waste. Yeah. But it all comes from this idea that we can somehow separate ourselves from the rest of nature so that we'd be protected from the negative outcomes. And that's, you know, it's just false. And it's a good starting point to change our way of thinking about our waste.
Right. And it's also to say that, you know, the point is not that this is kind of egalitarian or it spreads evenly across, human society. It's, of course, unequally distributed. Some do benefit from this, even if it's in a short-sighted way.
Yeah. Unfortunately, those people are the ones in control. The ones with the most, it's messed up, you know, the ones with the most say are the ones like that give the least shits. I mean, I just often think about this. I mean, it's just, you know, I think it's easy to just talk in thinking about the Anthropocene and climate change. It's easy to think that like, oh, humans did X and humans did Y, you know, and I'm not saying I don't benefit by lots of the things that, you know, civilization has produced. Of course, like I'm whatever, drinking tea from China right now. I mean, like, you know, that's, I'm benefiting from that. Like, am I happy? Like, do I want that? I mean, you know, am I happy about that? Like, if I could do it differently, would I? Absolutely, I would. But like, it's extremely difficult to do things much differently, in part because there really are, it's a small handful. It's like a 1%, a 0.1% of ultra powerful, you know, capitalists. And they have a lot to gain from this whole process in a very short term way of themselves thinking about what they have to gain in their lifetime. You know, it's not, I don't think it's all humanity's fault.
No.
I think the vast majority of humanity, you know, there are people who benefit disproportionately from fossil fuels and who use them disproportionately for sure. But I don't think everybody's like, would do that if they had an alternative. You know, even if they were benefiting, they might be like, yeah, I'm benefiting, but you know what? It'd be better if I didn't. And I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
And that's about how I feel. But I think even then, the vast majority of humans are not the fossil fuel consuming classes of the planet. Yeah. And even though you might say, oh, well, they're sort of complicit in the whole thing. I think that's a cop-out that makes it sound like everybody's down. Mm. Everybody's excited about this project. And I don't think that's true. Yeah. I think most people on the planet are not excited about about this project. They are not the contributors to climate change, and they are disproportionately the receivers of climate change damage and environmentally forced migrations. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think this is like some kind of fundamental human problem.
No.
This is a problem of the historical ruling classes, and for us now, It's the problem of an elite capitalist class, and you know, whatever. Yeah. So I think it's a small group of people.
So to kind of finalize our conversation here, I was wondering, what are the ethical implications of your philosophy or your, I guess, suggestions so that we don't end up in nihilism and doom and gloom and it's the end of the world kind of thinking?
Yeah, I think it's kind of funny it's very telling. Again, it's very telling that people would even think about this as a question of nihilism.
Yeah.
That the cosmos is going to die, and they're like, oh my God, the world's gonna die. This is the worst thing ever. And now the world means nothing to me, and I have no reason to be good or no reason to do anything because the cosmos is gonna die. I mean, that is such a specific geographical, historical, Indo-European orientation to the world. If there's no God, if there's no absolute universal laws of science or truth or whatever, it's not worth doing. Einstein said, if quantum physics is true, science is over.
Yeah,
I mean, he felt that strongly about it, that either we're going to get to universal deterministic laws or science is just pointless. You know, he really thought that. And I think that's a version of this kind of, that's a kind of scientific nihilism. And there's all kinds of other forms of nihilism. But I just have to stress again that this is like a very, this is not all humans come to that.
No,
that's not a natural, some built-in human response of like, the world is dying, therefore it's meaningless. And I'll just flag a couple. All of the myths that I said before, again, even back to the poetic Edda, the Norse mythology, to Mayan mythology, the world's going to die. The whole thing is going to die. Even the poet Lucretius was a Roman first century BC poet. That's the whole thing. The world is born, the world dies. It doesn't mean that it means nothing to us.
Yeah.
You know, it that is the way that it all plays out. So, ethical implications of this different way of thinking. That's old. It's not some new idea I have, although there's lots of science that, I mean, what I'm saying is based on what scientific evidence, but I'm saying that, you know, archaic and prehistoric traditions probably had similar ways of thinking based on the evidence. Some concrete conclusions or consequences. One would be composting in all of its forms. And I don't just mean like backyard composting. I mean, I think that we need to think about that differently and even do a lot of things differently. Mm-hmm. Things should be made such that they can die.
Yes.
Let's not make them immortal vampires. They should be able to, we should allow them to die and get over the metaphysics of accumulation quite performatively by letting all of the things that we make to have them die and go back to the earth, just like we will, to return to that and to share that with all the other organisms that will benefit by that being's death. Things have to die, and we should let them die.
Yeah.
And that includes, you know, projects of carbon sequestration and composting everything at every level, giving it another life. Including our literal biological waste. More than just recycling, you know, it's not about conserving through recycling. It's really about giving it over to the planet and letting much wiser, older organisms take hold of it and work their magic and do what they do on that material to let the rest of the planet participate instead of hoarding it all for ourselves.
Yeah.
The other one is, and this one I need to qualify, is trees. Okay. I said this big thing about we've chopped down half the trees on the planet. When I wrote the book, an article had just come out, kind of assessing whether we had enough space, non-occupied space on the planet where we could replant, trees and what the effect of carbon sequestration and how much that could slow the effects of climate change if we were able to plant trees in all the places that are available currently to plant trees. And the conclusion of the paper was roughly that there is enough room to plant, several billion trees. We have enough space. And if we did that, the article argues, we would be able to sequester a lot of carbon and we'd slow climate change down. And the article published in Nature, a prestigious journal, got lots of lots of different feedback. Some scientists wanting a more accurate assessment of how long all that was going to take, because we're talking about growing trees, and more specifically about growing ecosystems, not just monocropped oil palms. You know, really robust ecosystems are those are the most entropy producing, carbon sequestrating types of entities, not monocrop oil palms. So, but that's going to take time to develop those forests. And there was dispute. And then the people who wrote the original article responded back with more details about how long it would take. And they are still committed to their assessment that planting trees is the most, like, number one, most efficient, most carbon sequestrating single thing. And obviously, there's lots of things. It doesn't mean, like, let's just keep burning fossil fuels and plant trees. Yes, planting trees, but also stop destroying, you know, all kinds of, you know, forests and ecosystems elsewhere to generate carbon, which ends up in the oceans. And okay, so it's that's not the only thing. And it's not like a cop out of we don't have to do anything because we planted trees. That's stupid. But that is some people did react that way. And they're like, oh, planting trees can't be the only thing. And this is just an excuse for not doing and changing our fossil fuel habits. No, the number one thing to do is stop using fossil fuels, period. Everyone agrees on that. But number two is how to restore a deeply damaged Earth systems.
Right.
The number one way, again, not the only way, but it's a top way, is replanting the single largest biomass on the planet that humans over time, different groups, have destroyed. Here's the other one. So there was some scientific pushback and debate, which the authors have responded to, but then there are also all these, like, you know, kind of nonprofit and some of them, frankly, just secretly profit organizations, philanthropy and so on, that tried to get, I want to say, like, even Donald Trump, like, supported one of them. It's like, there's a couple now, Trillion Trees is one of them. But there's all these kind of, you know, shiesty organizations that are all about, like, basing it on this scientific paper saying, oh, we just need to replant trees. Again, missing the piece that we need to, like, reduce carbon emissions first, then replant and also plant all these trees. But then, like, when they do plant trees, you know, they're taking donations. People are like, yeah, plant 100 trees and I give you $1,000. And they got all this money. And there's an organization at the UN that was involved in planting these trees. But the politics of it was totally awful. I'm not suggesting anything of the sort, which is to say they just show up in, like, you know, indigenous land and kick the people off to plant monocrop palms that they then, after like 30 years, they plan to cut them and sell them and make money from them. It's like, no, the whole point is not to grow the tree and cut it down. And the whole point is not just to cut a monocrop or displace indigenous people. The goal was to regrow, and it needs to be to regrow robust, biodiverse ecosystems. Yes. You can't just plant any kind of tree anywhere. The trees have to be appropriate to the set. Okay. You could imagine every way that this whole idea of planting trees could go wrong in a deeply capitalist society with a completely upside down metaphysics could go. That's how it went. They used planting trees to generate money and capital. Everybody felt better about themselves for doing it. That's terribly unfortunate, but I still stand by the original idea that reforestation of biodiverse and appropriate places that are not displacing people is possible and is probably on the top of the list of, we don't need necessarily some magical new technology. Although again, it probably couldn't hurt as long as we were also planting trees. But my perspective here is that for whatever reasons the article is giving, they are not citing entropy and thermodynamics as the reason why it works. But I'm going to say that that is what is going on when you do it. Regardless of whether they're saying that that's what's going on, that is objectively, thermodynamically, what is going on. If you plant a trillion trees, you are going to, and they're biodiverse, they have time to develop and appropriate for their ecosystems or whatever, you are going to increase the planetary entropy. You just are. That's what's going to happen. If you also decrease fossil fuels, reforest the planet, the end result of that will be increased entropy. And I mean, it'll be other things too. But from a thermodynamic perspective, that is the problem we have, is we've got a lower entropy planet than we had before, and we need to increase that entropy in a sustainable way back up to higher levels if we're going to survive and keep it metastable.
So thank you so much, Thomas, for joining us in this podcast. It was a super interesting conversation, very provocative, which I really, really love. And in a sense, the conversation and also your work feels to me like you're feeding us humans a very healthy portion of humble pie. And I would like to invite you to keep feeding us humble pie because we really, really need it. So thank you so much for being with us. It was a super interesting conversation.
Yeah, thank you as well.
This was the Ecology of Ideas podcast. Production and editing by Emil Monk. My name is Otto de Marton, co-producer and host. Special thanks to the Copenhagen Business School for financing this episode. And to Jakob Ranum, sound engineer at Studio 25 in Copenhagen, where we recorded this episode. Thanks for listening, and we are out.